So welcome to the Speak Your Truth podcast, episode one. I'm Amanda Daniel Monroe, and thank you for tuning in. We're here today to talk about the topic of racism, especially within the context of what's happening right now in America. There's a lot of things that we want to talk about and get to, but first I want to go ahead and introduce my friend Mallory. And we'll be talking about your voice memos today, as well as some really cool resources to check out to learn more.
Yeah. Hey, everyone. My name is Mallory. I'm super excited Amanda asked me to join her for this podcast. I'm a white queer woman. I live in the Metro Atlanta area. And yeah, we both were feeling sort of overwhelmed and saddened by this happening again and again. And it just seems like now more than ever is really the time to speak up and say something and make it explicitly clear what your values are and what you stand for and what kind of world you want to live in.
Yes, definitely. And Mallory and I have known each other for a while now. I'm originally from the Atlanta area as well. Now I'm out here in Santa Clara with my husband, Eric, and I'm multiracial, Black, Puerto Rican. So we'll go ahead and get started, just a little bit about us so you know who we are. So what we did is we reached out to people and we asked them to go ahead and send us some voice memos about what's on their mind about, you know, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, just whatever people were feeling. And we really wanted to just, steer the conversation in that way. But first of all, today is Tuesday. Feels like it's been a long day. And I want to kind of take the quick opportunity to talk about, you know, what's going on today in the news and where we are with things. So, of course, George Floyd's funeral happened today, several hours ago. I was able to kind of tune in for that a little bit, and I did see that the families of other Black people that were killed by the police, like Eric Garner's family, Michael Brown's family, they were also in attendance at the funeral. I thought that was really moving to kind of see all those families together. And of course, Reverend Al Sharpton was there. He did make some remarks about the family that I think was really important to note, just the fact that the family did not ask to be activists. And so, you know, that's a lot of pressure to put on people and on all those families. And just to kind of keep that in mind, that we really need to be here to support those families as well and speak out. So just something to kind of note. Another thing too that we wanted to quickly talk about is the House Democrats just released the Justice and Policing Act of 2020, which has 200 sponsors on it. I was just reading a little bit about it really quickly, but it would prohibit chokeholds, ban no-knock warrants in drug-related cases. Of course, we know about that from Breonna Taylor, among other things. So just a couple of things that I wanted to mention before we kind of jump into our conversation. So really quickly, gonna play some audio files and we'll go ahead and start talking.
Hi, I'm a white male in my late 20s. I know and understand my privilege. I grew up not ever fearing the police. They were family friends. I'd see them at church. What I didn't know when I was young was that this wasn't everyone's experience, that just because I was white, I experienced the world very differently than others. I began realizing that there were differences in middle school, but it wasn't until late high school and into college that I began to understand what these differences actually were and why they existed, how policing policies have maintained and enforced the status quo that we see today, how differently police treated places like the south side of Atlanta than the more affluent parts of the city. As I have grown older, I have tried to keep my eye open and understand these problems more and correct the ideas of others and hope that once educated, they also continue to do the same with people around them. The policing policies that have reinforced the systematic racism that has oppressed people of color in this country for centuries has got to change. And it is going to take something big to have the long-lasting effects that we need to see. Thank you.
So I wanted to start the conversation around policing and the history of policing in America. And Mallory, I know that we've talked a little bit about this in the past, but just kind of the idea that policing in general is, you know, about 150 years old. It's not as old of an institution as people may think, right?
Yeah, no, it's really brand new. Like when you look at like, you know, not to be like a cliche, like ever since the dawn of time, but you know, comparatively like 150 years is not that long of time at all. And you know, one of the original intentions of, you know, a sort of police band was to capture runaway slaves and return them to, you know, the people that claim they own these human beings. So it's a very new institution that has some really direct ties to systemic racism.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's really important to make sure that we realize. And, you know, that was definitely happening in the South, very prominent. And, you know, thinking about the North and some of the more urban areas, they were definitely using the police to, you know, kind of control labor. So, you know, around the 1880s and things like that, where workers were striking for better working conditions, the police really came to deal with a lot of that, as well as, you know, union breaking. So just something that we kind of wanted to bring up, since that's been something that people have been talking about recently. So, you know, kind of, you know, there to control disorder, not so much, you know, to catch murderers and things like that, that, you know, would be the first thing that would come to mind. But another thing too, Mallory, that I wanted to talk to you about is, you know, kind of why do people commit crimes, and, you know, kind of having a conversation around that and how that's related to policing here too.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, like people have this vision of the police as, you know, these are the people that quote unquote protect us from criminals. You know, we can't, you know, abolish the police, defund them, whatever. We can't do that because who's going to protect us from crime? And if we want to talk about crime, we really have to talk about, well, why do people commit crimes? The answer to that is almost always due to a lack of resources. These are resources like housing, healthcare, education, mental health services, social services, a strong community. And so if we, you know, if we take the time and put the money, perhaps more importantly, into things like affordable housing, healthcare, invest directly into communities, if we take the money and put it there, crime will go down. And this is something that studies have proven in cities where they have, you know, disbanded or reformed the police. Like, studies show that crime does go down once people's, you know, basic needs are met, and once they feel secure that, you know, they are far less likely to commit a crime that the police would need to intervene on.
Right, exactly. And I do want us to kind of pivot and talk a little bit about the protesting. So I'm going to go ahead and play an audio file that was sent to us.
The response from protesting by the police has really shed light on exactly what is wrong with the system and why so many people are calling for the defunding of the police forces. One of my friends from school is a photographer, videographer who went to a protest in Dallas, Texas to document everything that was going on in their city. While recording and backing away from the police, he was shot in the face with a clay bullet. He broke bones in his cheek and will have to have surgery to put metal plates in his face. He is permanently scarred. He was not rioting. He was not armed, and now he's changed forever.
So when I listened to this, I was really shocked. I did kind of follow up and read some other stories that were similar. And it's really hard to see those pictures. It's really hard to see the protesters that have been hit, people that have, you know, lost an eye and things like that, that they're permanently scarred from this. And it all, you know, when we're talking about how militarized and how violent the cops are, it kind of lines up with that when we're seeing this just play out in front of us on TV.
Yeah, I mean, like, people who aren't even directly involved in these protests are, you know, frankly, you know, victims of drive-by police violence. You know, like that woman in Dallas, the young woman in Dallas who was just walking home with groceries near a protest, she got hit with a rubber bullet. And I saw the pictures. I'm sure you, Amanda, and everyone listening, like, I'm sure y'all also saw those as well. You know, they're horrifying. Like, this woman, you know, and I don't even want to get into, you know, if she was involved in the protest, should she have been shot? Because that's bull, frankly. But, you know, like, she was just walking by, and next thing you know, she's bleeding out all over the sidewalk because a cop shot her in the face.
Right. And that's ridiculous, too. I mean, and from I think what I understand.
That's why. Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and I think, like this, like, stories like that, and, like, of all the other stories I'm hearing as well from people protesting, are why, like, I don't want to see any more pictures of police kneeling with protesters or taking these symbolic gestures to try to show that, you know, like, oh, no, like, we're with you guys. We got you. We understand. We know the struggle. And then, you know, they kneel for a photo op, and then the photo op's done, and they're tear gassing and shooting rubber bullets at the same people they were just kneeling next to. Like, that's happening over and over in cities and cities, and it's just cop propaganda. Like, it's just propaganda to make you think, like, oh, no. Like, some cops are good. I would say if there is a good cop, they would quit their job immediately and find a new job and walk away from policing.
Yeah, so I'm really glad that you brought up that topic about the protesters and kind of, like, the cops... you know, kneeling together. And that's definitely one of the hard topics that I wanted to talk about, because we have been seeing that the media's, you know, really highlighting those instances. And we're seeing videos and shots, like people setting up these kind of photo ops with the cops. It's really interesting. I'm interested to talk more about that, because, like you said, 1 second, we're kneeling, and then the next second we're macing people or pushing groups back. So let's just see the whole situation for what it is. You know, we can talk about our take on that. What is that? You know, the kneeling, is that kindness? You know, the hugging each other? What are protesters trying to bring attention to? You know, like, I don't think that the kneeling is meeting that goal.
No, it's not. And, like, this is something that I feel very strongly on, and I think I said it before, and I'll say it again just to be really clear on this so everyone knows. If they really were truly good cops, they wouldn't be kneeling with protesters. They would be turning in their badges and guns, like yesterday, to be frank. But, you know, it, like, honestly, like, I'm just not interested in that, you know. And people trying to present this image of, oh, look at these handful of good cops, you know, out here kneeling with protesters. You know, I'm not interested in that. I think that is all just cop publicity, propaganda, whatever you want to call it. I think all it's doing is it's trying to draw attention away from the matter at hand, which is, no, this is a systemic issue. Police brutality against Black people is something that happens over and over throughout this country and throughout police departments. It's not just a couple of bad cops or a couple of bad precincts who are doing this.
Right. No, I agree. And, you know, for people who may be listening in and thinking, oh, you know, that sounds kind of extreme. You expect people to just walk off the job. Well, we have definitely seen a situation similar where the cops, I'm sure some people have seen this already, but in Buffalo, New York, where the cops knocked over an older man, an older white man. He ended up in the hospital.
It was a 75-year-old man. I believe.
Yeah. And I believe that they had suspended the cops that were specifically involved in that. And the rest of the cops resigned from that specific team, that patrol team, in solidarity with them. So, you know, some cops feel very strongly about the role that they play, and they feel strongly about their rights to do the things that they do when they're on the clock. And so I'm not really surprised that on the other end of it, that we would kind of expect people that see the system for what it is to leave it, you know, to say, this isn't right. I don't want to be involved in this type of work.
And I think too, like the thing that I keep coming back to, and I think hopefully other people are coming back to as well, is that being a cop is a job. It's not an identity. It's not an identity you were born with. It's not something that, you know, you can, you know, go home and hang, well, you can't go home and hang it up, but you know, like if you're black, you cannot just forget about the color of your skin for that day. Or, you know, that great Wanda, I think it was Wanda Sykes made that joke about, you know, like being a woman wanting to put her away while she's going out. We're definitely going to have to bleep out there. Sorry about that. but, you know, like being a cop, like it's not an inherent feature of who a person is. It's not part of their identity. It's not like someone being black or someone being, you know, someone being queer, someone being brown, whatever it might be. Like it's a profession, and you need to find another job, because having your whole identity hung up in this power trip is killing people over and over.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that kind of really ties into what I was going to talk about with the police versus Black Lives Matter. You know, people talk about being pro-police versus Black Lives Matter, this weird juxtaposition that's been created. And like you said, being a cop is a job. It's not an identity. It's not like a race or ethnicity or religion.
It's not a protected class. It's not. It's a job.
Yeah. So it's weird that we're even talking about these two things in that way. You know, and it's, I think sometimes it's as simple as, you know, do you believe that there's discrimination toward Black people in policing? Yes or no? If so, then let's look at the solutions and let's look at what we can do to change that as soon as possible. Because this has just gotten to the point where it's ridiculous.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think, too, another good point to make is that, you know, cops on a whole think and look differently than American society in general as well. So when we're trying to understand police and their behaviors and, you know, what they're thinking, I know the Pew Center for Research in 2016 did a survey, and there's not really a lot of data out there about police attitudes, but this one, specifically this survey, was done by 8,000 police officers. And what's interesting is that in general, American society and the police are on different ends of the spectrum when it comes to believing that there's racism in policing. And I think that that was really interesting. The majority of cops do not believe that there's racism in policing, and they don't believe that that's a problem.
That's concerning, to say the least.
Yeah. And, you know, once again, very important to point out that as a whole, the police officers in America are more likely to be white and male. You know, once again, a little bit different than America in general. And we have to really think about how to have conversations with people that don't believe that there's systemic racism mm-hmm. in policing. I mean, what do you think about about that? Where do you go from there?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like if you can't even like agree on the basic terms, which in this case is there is systemic racism in policing, if you can't agree on those very basic terms, how can you even have a productive conversation about it? Because I know over the last like week or so, I've had some friends who like have never really said anything about racism in this country, you know, start to say things and be like, oh, like the police, like maybe they aren't so good after all. Who knew? But people who are like just learning and who are like just coming to accept those terms of, yes, there is a huge problem with racism and policing in America. If we can't both agree on that basic agreed common ground, then how are we supposed to have a conversation if we can't agree on the facts? I'm just going to say it, that's a fact. There is racism and policing in America today. Full stop.
Right. And, you know, one thing that I've heard a lot, especially in the past, and I used to believe this too, at one point, is that the problem is cops need to be trained better. Mm-hmm. They need to know about implicit bias. They need to know that they have these biases, and so they just need to train more. But you can give them all the training in the world, but if they don't believe that mm-hmm. they're racist, then of course nothing's ever going to change, you know? Mm-hmm. So I really understand a little bit better now, seeing this whole picture and knowing what I know now, that it's not just as simple as making it harder to be a cop as far as requiring more education, requiring more training, things like that. I think that that's mm-hmm. an easy answer for people to turn to.
Exactly. I mean, it's much like, you know, body cams, when those were all the talk, you know, back in 2014, when this was happening with Mike Brown and Eric Garner, you know, that was all the talk was, well, if we give police body cams and they film everything, then like that's going to, you know, introduce some accountability and introduce some, you know, concrete evidence, which, you know, all that sounds nice, I suppose, until you think about, oh, they can turn off the body cam, or, oh, we have footage, and we do have footage of them murdering Black people on camera, and they have yet to be brought to justice for it. Like, right. I think you're right, like, people do want to, like, point to, like, this one simple, easy thing, like, body cams, better training, whatever it might be. They want to point to something small and address that, and think that doing that one little thing is somehow going to just, like, magically solve racism and policing, when it's not. It's just something, I think, frankly, to make white people in particular feel better, like, oh, like, we're doing better now. The cops have body cams. We can go back on about our lives. Nothing else to see here.
Right.
Until in a few months when another Black person is murdered by the cops. Right.
And I think that that is a really important point to make too, is another Black person is most likely going to be killed by a cop. I mean, that's mm-hmm. gonna happen. So this is real. This is life or death for Black people, you know, and mm-hmm. we can't pay lip service. We can't, mm-hmm. you know, continue to talk about the same solutions that aren't working. We definitely need to do something different and something big, like you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't want to talk too much about the protest versus looting, but I do want to kind of mention that, because I think it's really similar to the cops kneeling kind of things that we've been seeing in the media, and that we keep having these conversations about what is looting is, you know, you can't be okay with looting, and the protesters are out of control, and, you know, you're either for the protesters or you're against the protesters, and they're not. It's not that easy, and I think it distracts from the issue at hand, like you said earlier, mm-hmm. what mm-hmm. is the goal? Why are people out here protesting?
Exactly. You know, like you know, we were just saying, like, it's so much easier to have a conversation about looting and breaking windows and stealing, because those are all seen as, you know, quote unquote bad things. You know, most people would agree that yes, stealing is wrong, busting someone else's window is wrong. And so people, I think, want to cling to this, you know, splitting it into protest versus looting. They want to split it that way and focus on, you know, the looting and not really address the real issue, which is people are frustrated. They have been yelling about this for years and years and years, going unheard. And frankly, who gives a if someone's windshield is busted in the process? You know, windows, material goods, those can all be replaced, but people's lives cannot be replaced.
Right. I believe that that is an important point to make. Like, every day that something is not done to change the police system in America is another day that someone can be losing their life. And so mm-hmm. I think it's important to kind of stay in here for the long haul when it comes to protesting and yep. supporting the protests in any way that you can, because that's really going to be the way that we're going to see the change. And as we kind of continue to protest, we kind of start to see the ideas come out, and like defunding the police and things like that, that we'll talk about later. But really quick, mm-hmm. before we get to that and before we get to talking about some resources, I want to play another audio file.
Hello, I just want to preface my statements with the fact that I am a white male, and so that I recognize that I have quite a lot of privilege in this society. But I think something that white people can do right now is to recognize covert racism in their own lives. There's a great graphic going around on the internet right now with overt racism on an iceberg, and beneath the surface is covert racism. I think people can look at that graphic and choose to be actively anti-racist in their life. I think they should continue to learn about that and recognize it in themselves and fight it and learn more about it and keep the conversation going past just these few weeks, and keep on making sure to raise Black voices, recognize it, and all that stuff.
All right, so yeah, speaking of ways that we can learn, I thought that was great information there. And I've definitely seen a lot of that circulating on social media. So just to make a couple of plugs for some resources, I wanted to mention the Innocence Project. I've been kind of following them for several years. And what the Innocence Project does, it's a group of lawyers, and they work to not only get wrongful convictions overturned, but to try to prevent future injustice. And so they're definitely doing some really great work. And, you know, we're talking about people that have been convicted, falsely accused, you know, whether that's from false confessions, eyewitness misidentification, and these people have spent years in the system, years in jail, and they're innocent. And so, I mean, it's really compelling. They have a Netflix series called The Innocence Files that I would recommend people to check out. And a lot of what they're doing is around DNA. So using DNA to try to clear some folks there and kind of try to right some wrongs. It's sad, and it's another problem that we have here. It's all related as far as the judicial system and policing. So they're doing a lot of really great work. And I wanted to just mention them because they're a huge organization. They have a lot of resources on their website as well, too. And that's going to direct you to other groups that may be more aligned with things that you're passionate about, you know, people listening in. So definitely check out Innocence Project. I know that we haven't talked about the bail system, but there's definitely, we could definitely do an episode on that on its own. And I I wanted to go ahead and talk about the National Bail Fund Project and definitely check them out. Another great organization trying to combat mass incarceration and, you know, disrupt the money bail system. So that's how they're trying to come at it. And they're currently paying the bail of protesters as well. So there's a lot of bail projects as well, too, regionally, by state and whatnot, and a lot of different groups that are doing this. If you want to know more about the bail system, definitely check out Last Week Tonight on HBO. John Oliver does a segment on that, so you can always just type that into YouTube and kind of get a little taste of what the bail system does and how it disproportionately affects Black communities by keeping people that may be innocent and just can't afford bail incarcerated.
And making the bail higher for people of color as well.
Right.
It's cheaper for white people's bail than it is people of color.
Right. And Campaign Zero, just wanted to mention that if you're data people and you like to see data, if you want to be informed and throw some data in people's faces, I would suggest going to Campaign Zero because they have so much good information on policing. I learned so much when I checked it out as far as what they have, like a whole system set out on how we can make policing better. And they talk about each piece and how each piece is important. Like we said, there's not one silver bullet or one simple solution that's going to get rid of systemic racism in policing. It's going to be a combination of multiple things. And they really talk about some really good topics. It's data driven. And a couple of things I thought was interesting is, once again, talking about the body cams. Body cams obviously were not the silver bullet that people thought they were going to be for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, ending policing as a revenue stream. So getting rid of quotas and things like that, too. So a lot of really good information and something that you should definitely check out. I wanted to really just quickly touch on the topic of defunding police because that's been in the news more recently.
Yeah.
And it's been interesting to kind of see that conversation on the news, in the media, and just wanted to see what you thought about it and kind of give people an opportunity to kind of explore this topic a little bit more.
Well, I will be completely honest. If you would have asked me, we'll just say like 2.5 weeks or so ago, my thoughts on this topic, you know, abolishing the police and abolishing prisons, I probably would have been like, well, I mean, sure. I mean, I guess that sounds good, but like, how do you even accomplish something like that? And, you know, what about this? What about that? But in the last, like, I don't know, week and a half or so, I don't know, time is not real anymore. But in the last, you know, several days and weeks, I have done a complete 180 and am now screaming whenever I get the chance to defund the police, abolish the police, close every prison. And I think a lot of people are having that same wake-up call right now that, you know, we've tried reforming the police. We've tried, you know, giving them different kinds of training. We've tried body cams. We've tried, you know, all of this, and it's still not working. And so I think that, you know, that for me is, you can't, if something is so fundamentally tainted by systemic racism, you can't reform that. You, like, it is so soaked in blood, mm-hmm. That you just, you can't fix it. There's no way. And the thing about abolition that I, and I will say that I am still very, very much learning on this, and I'm still very new to it. But there are so many well-documented abolitionist documents and readings and videos. There's so much information out there that once you start really, you know, thinking about it and digging down and doing the reading and the research, it starts to make a lot of sense. And I think that's why, you know, all of a sudden you're seeing people, you know, calling to defund the police, you know, who may or may not have had strong political opinions before, you know, I think people are finally realizing, like, no, like, police aren't really necessary for society. Like, what are they doing that we couldn't do in a better way without them?
Right. No. Yeah, I think it's really interesting. When I first heard about defunding the police or abolishing the police, I also was a little bit confused. I'm never one to just come out and say, wow, that sounds crazy. I just don't believe that's going to work. But I definitely was curious, like you said, as to how something like that would even play out. And I you know, encourage people anytime that they hear about these kind of topics in the news and in the media to just go ahead and find out for yourself. I mean, you know, that's the best way to kind of form your own opinion. I think a lot of people kind of rely on social media and what those around them believe. And I think that it's important to kind of just go out there and look for yourself. There are some towns and some cities in America that have either abolished the police or defunded the police. And, you know, it's definitely something that's happened. And, you know, they were talking about Camden, New Jersey, not that long ago. So if anyone's interested in kind of hearing about how something like this could work, look up Camden, New Jersey. They were known as one of the most violent and dangerous towns in the country. And it was so, the police department was so corrupt, and there was so much homicide happening, so much, so many drug issues, that they basically said, I think this was in 2013, you know, we're going to have to just get rid of this. Yeah, we're going to have to just scrap this. Yeah. This isn't working. I believe that they brought in the county police department, and they kind of worked from there. And of course, some of the cops were hired back and things like that. They had to go through very intense interviews and assessments and things like that to be hired on. But they basically changed the way that the police, you know, what the police were responsible for in Camden. And, you know, definitely check it out. They did a lot of really cool things. The cops, you know, once they were hired, they went into the neighborhoods, they introduced themselves, knocked on doors. They started having community events that the cops would run. The cops would come in with ice cream trucks and things like that. And they began to kind of serve this other role as, you know, part of the community. And it's not a perfect solution over there. I've definitely heard some critiques, and I think they still have a ways to go. But their homicides went down from 67 in 2012 to 25 last year. So that's intense. That's pretty good numbers there. And, you know, as far as excessive force complaints, those went down from 65 to just 3. I mean, that's powerful. And so I think they're still working on representation and trying to get more people of color in the police department to, you know, kind of reflect the community a little bit better. And I think now they're kind of grappling with other issues as far as how do we bring up our community in other ways? You know, we're working on the police, we're heading in the right direction, but we still have issues with poverty, a bad school system, and things like that. So those things definitely have to, they need resources, you know, they need resources. And that's what's really, I think, going to make the difference. And that's why you hear about the defunding along with, you know, redirecting those funds to the community. I want to play another audio file, and then we'll just kind of quickly discuss it. And then I want us to kind of talk about what's giving us hope. So we've had a lot of conversation so far about the things that are wrong with the policing system. You know, we've talked about some resources and things that we'd like people to check out. And I'd like to kind of end with some good news. So we'll be right back.
I personally feel that the president being so openly racist has encouraged other white supremacists to speak out. How do you think having Trump as president has affected the next generation?
Wow. So that's definitely a good question about Trump and about future generations. What do you think about that, Mallory?
I think it's a really great question. It's one, I guess I should clarify, I'm 29 years old, so I don't, you know, I know Bush was, you know, bad for like 8 years of my life, but I don't remember too much of it because at the time I was in like middle school, yeah, middle school, early high school. So like I wasn't, you know, as clued in to everything that was going on. But I think the thing that trips me up about it is, you know, like people who are like 14, 15 teenagers now, like they are so much more plugged into the world than I think you or I ever were, Amanda. You know, like they have smartphones, definitely. You know, they've had smartphones for years. They're very much connected. And so I think, you know, the Trump presidency does feel a lot more personal and, you know, unnerving to them than, you know, Bush felt to, you know, you or I at the time. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. I think that we can't deny that Trump is racist. I think that that's something that we need to all be able to agree on. I mean, we have plenty of examples of things that he's mm-hmm. said in the past.
There's a whole Wikipedia page, people. Just saying.
Yes, look up the Wikipedia page.
Literally, racial opinions of Donald Trump. It's a whole wiki.
Yes, The Atlantic has something. I mean, there's a lot of resources on this. Yeah. And, you know, as far as Obama with the birth certificate drama and, you know, Charlottesville, good people on both sides. And just recently with MAGA and, you know, the comment that he made about how MAGA loves black people, things like that. Just very odd, very weird, but and some just downright wrong, period. I think we can agree that it can't be healthy for our community. No. It can't be helping either. And I hope that younger generations will not be the worst for it. And I hope that people are banding together and that they do believe that the things that he's saying are so wrong and so ridiculous. And I, you know, honestly, I'm ready for this nightmare to be over. I'm ready to move on. I don't think that we can heal or start to heal as a nation with poor leadership mm-hmm. and the, you know, the poor leadership that we've seen so far. It's just not going to happen. It just can't happen.
Yeah.
And I think that would be devastating to future generations. You know, we need to keep moving forward. And, you know, of course, we're going to vote and we're going to mm-hmm. do all that we can to get the elected officials that we know can make a change. But we're also going to protest and we're going to try to make voting fair. And there's a lot of things that we need to do. It's not just one answer.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. There's a lot of things we need to do. And I think we're going to talk about this later. But like voting, in my mind, is like the bare minimum that you do as an informed, responsible citizen. You should be protesting as well, donating to organizations, donating to bail funds, mutual aid funds, having difficult conversations with your family and friends, especially if you're a white person, talking to other white people in your life. That, yeah, you know, because the thing about it is that, yes, like, Trump is absolutely a nightmare, horrible, racist person, full stop. But it's not like these issues, like, just began with him. Like, in a lot of ways, he is sort of like the figurehead of, right, you know, racism and the like. But even if he does get voted out by Joe Biden, which we won't get into that right now, but even if he, you know, loses in November, it's not like all of these issues are going to go away. Because I think one of the things that tripped me up the most about the 2016 election was he was just saying such outright racist things out loud in public for all to hear, completely in context. Like, there was no explaining it away. It was just straight up racist. And the fact that someone felt so, I hate to use this word, empowered, because it has such a good connotation, but that, you know, that he felt so empowered to say things like that. And then people were like, yeah, yeah, I feel the same. Let me unload all my racist thoughts on you right here, right now. That to me is what is really scary. And what I thought about back in 2016 was, even if this guy loses, he has brought to the surface a whole bunch of really, really disgusting racist filth along with him that's not going away anytime soon.
Right. And I think that a lot of people for the last 4 years have been scared to talk about Trump and how they feel about him one way or another. And I think it's very similar to the way that people don't like to talk about race, but this is something that we had to talk about. It's not politics. This person is racist, he's divisive, and we're trying to do the exact opposite of that. We're trying to bring equity and peace to America. And so, you know, we have to just call it for what it is, regardless of if we're Republican, Democrat, Independent, etc. So I wanted to thank you for taking the time out to come and talk with me about this. This is my first time doing a podcast, and we both have learned a lot about podcasting, we have to say. And, you know, all the technical things and any issue that you can think of, we have been through to make this one episode. So
I think this one might be the one. Hopefully.
Yes, hopefully that this is the one.
I feel like I shouldn't say that as I'm still looking at my recording going live, but hopefully this is finally the one.
Yes. And so I definitely want to thank everyone who's listening in. I hope that you've enjoyed the audio files. I hope you enjoyed the conversation, and maybe you've learned something new, or maybe you've taken down a note or two of something that you want to explore a little bit more. We have so much more topics could cover. And I think if people are interested, I'm down to continue to flesh out some of these things. So if you like it, listen, tell your friends about it. I want to close the podcast with something a little bit lighter, you know, and maybe talk about one thing that's giving us hope today for the future.
I know for me, definitely, it was hearing the news that the Minneapolis City Council voted unanimously, or not unanimously, but they voted veto-proofedly, that they were going to disband the police department in Minneapolis. And to me, that is so huge and so exciting that they took such deliberate, bold action so quickly, too. Like, none of that bullshit just, like, sitting around and, like, politics going back and forth forever and ever. Like, they were just said, no, no more. We're done here. We're ending this right here, right now, today. And so I think that's really cool and exciting.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree that that's good to see real change happening during this time of protest, you know, and I think that kind of helps keep the momentum going and keep people invested in having these conversations. And we need to see a lot more of that. I've been thinking a little bit about this and what's giving me hope. I think one thing that's given me hope is that I was driving around our area here in the Bay Area. And just, you know, this weekend on random corners, there were people protesting and saying Black Lives Matter. And I don't know, it made me feel really good that people were taking the time out to just sit on a corner by themselves and hold up a sign. And It made me feel like we have allies out there and we have people that get it. And they don't need to go and join a huge protest, that they're still out there trying to get their voice heard and, you know, lend themselves to the cause. And so that was really heartening to see that. Of course, I said I watched the George Floyd funeral earlier, and I felt very hopeful with a lot of the things that I heard during the funeral. I felt hopeful when I saw the moms of the Black individuals that were killed by the cops all joining together and praying and whatnot. You know, even though I'm not a religious person, I felt very honored to be a Black person. And I felt like a renewed kind of commitment to doing everything that I can, especially for those families. They've been through so much. And I think that this is the least that we can do, is to kind of try to take some of that load and that, you know, these people didn't ask to be activists. You know, they're dealing with losing someone in their family. And so I really want to do everything that I can to support Black folks. And I think that, you know, a lot of great things can happen if we all just work together and we just keep talking, keep communicating about these things.
Once this news cycle dies down, keep going, keep pushing onward, keep having the conversations, keep getting involved. Because I think another more general hopeful thing for me was, I remember back in 2014, you know, watching coverage of Ferguson and all the protests that were happening there, but it was still very much confined to Ferguson and maybe a few other major cities, I can't quite remember. But what's been so heartening about all this has been seeing, we had protests in all 50 states about this.
Right,
amazing. You know, people just saying collectively, no, enough is enough. We are not standing for this anymore. And the fact that all 50 states had, and most are still having these protests, several other countries, I think the last number I heard was 13, maybe 18.
Wow.
Many other countries were also having protests in support of Black Lives Matter. And to see just how collectively most people in my life and people in the world at large are saying, no, no more. This is unacceptable and we are not going to shut up about it.
Right. No, I think that's a really good point. Well, thank you again, Mallory, for joining me. And to everybody out there, stay safe, stay healthy, and hopefully maybe we'll talk to you soon again.
Yeah, see ya.
See ya.